Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority. Sleep Science Today and Sleep Better Tonight.
Is it insomnia, sleep apnea, or something else? What's really causing your daytime sleepiness? We're going to find out today on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we have a sleep doctor, a guest, Dr. Eric Sklar, and we are going to have him answer all of those questions and more for us. So, Dr. Sklar, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
We're glad to have you here. We really appreciate you joining us so that you can help us answer a lot of the questions that we need answered. Okay, so let's start off. A lot of people complain about daytime sleepiness, and some of them will say, you know, I feel like I got good sleep at night, but still, man, I'm tired during the day. Or others will say, I've always gotten miserable sleep and I never seem to be able to improve it. Can you give us an idea of what might be going on there?
Well, there could be a lot of different things. And that's what we do when we evaluate patients. We want to find out what's going on at night. Do they have any disruptions? What are the people around them saying? You know, how much sleep are they getting? Some people have bad habits that can contribute to that. And then there are other conditions that are not necessarily related to poor sleep at night, but are what we call central disorders of hypersomnolence. So there's a wide variety of different things that that might present as a sleep problem.
So, yeah, it sounds like there's a lot to get in there when we talk about the central sleep disorders versus others. I guess maybe this would be a good place to talk about the concept of sleep apnea, because I know there's obstructive sleep apnea and then there's central sleep apnea. So maybe you can educate us a little bit on what is sleep apnea and then what's the difference between the types of sleep apnea.
Sure. Yeah, so sleep apnea, I mean, simply put, apnea literally means no breath. So in a broad sense, it's basically what we would call sleep disturbed breathing. People are having trouble breathing at night during their sleep. The most common kind of sleep apnea is obstructive sleep apnea. And if you think about it anatomically, it's exactly what it sounds like. Obstruction that is preventing the patient from breathing well. That obstruction usually occurs like towards the back of the throat and the upper airway. When people lie down to sleep and feel kind of relaxed, the tissues, the muscles relax, the tongue relaxes, and the tissues can collapse and cause an obstruction in airflow. And that leads to an apnea or something on that spectrum. So that is the most common type of sleep apnea that we see. And that's usually related to factors including obesity, male sex. That's very highly linked to snoring. That would be a big red flag. But that is the predominant type of sleep apnea that we see. Central sleep apnea is something different, and it's seen in a different population, although you can actually have just say a third type of sleep apnea called mixed sleep apnea, where you have some combination of both. But central sleep apnea is really more of the brain kind of skipping a signal to the diaphragm to take a breath. So there's not an obstruction there that's causing an apnea, but it's actually more of a signal abnormality. And that is more commonly seen in certain situations, such as congestive heart failure, possibly in patients who have had strokes, people that are on narcotic therapy. Those are some of the more common causes of central apnea. And so it's important to be able to differentiate, because treatments are generally the same kind of thing, but But for central apnea, there's really less variety of treatments, and would require a specific treatment.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, I want to make sure that we talk about treatments, but before we get there, I'd like to get a little bit of clarification on some things. you know, you talked about, you know, generally males have obstructive sleep apnea, certain characteristics, but what about women? Because I've come across a lot of women who are not necessarily carrying extra weight, no particular factors that you would think this person has sleep apnea, yet a lot of them have it. So what's going on there with women?
Yeah, I mean, so women, especially postmenopausal women, also are about similar risk to men. But weight is not the only factor, and there are other factors as well. There are some genetic factors, and that's mostly how it relates to orofacial anatomy. People who have recessed chins or like a small chin, they would be at a higher risk just because there's less room in the airway, and that makes them more susceptible to an obstruction, to sleep apnea. So, obesity certainly is a big risk factor, but by no means is it the only one. And we certainly see plenty of patients that are not particularly obese, and certain populations as well that have higher risks for sleep apnea regardless.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what are some common ways that people who may have sleep apnea and not know it, how do they become aware that they have sleep apnea?
Yeah, well, usually someone is going to have some symptoms. There's two kind of pathways to being evaluated, I would say. So the obvious one is someone who is snoring at night. They have a partner that says maybe they stop breathing. So the patient might not be aware of that, the patient might be aware of waking up kind of gasping occasionally. That would be obviously a red flag. But really, you know, patients might present with daytime sleepiness. They might just not feel refreshed when they wake up in the morning, or they get tired easily during the day. And this is despite getting, 7 or 8 hours of sleep. Or they might wake up a lot for no clear reason, or maybe they have to go to the bathroom a lot. That can be a sign of sleep apnea. So a lot of times, sometimes people think what they're having might not be anything, but it could be a sign of sleep apnea. The other way that we see people, and this would really be people who have no symptoms at all, would be patients who have certain medical conditions. So we know that there's a high link between sleep apnea and atrial fibrillation risk, which is an arrhythmia. So patients who are seen in arrhythmia clinics, we often would recommend that they get screened for sleep apnea, and they may have other risk factors that they're not even aware of, and they don't have to be a big snorer, and they may or may not be very tired during the day. Although I would argue that a lot of people kind of downplay their tiredness. They attribute things like their job or their family, all legitimate contributors, but they attribute their tiredness to other things other than maybe a medical disorder. So those patients, again, if they're screened, they have risk factors, they should be evaluated, and we often find that they do have sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So, you know, oftentimes, you know, we hear about, like you had said as well, if you have a sleep partner in your bed and they notice that you're snoring or gasping for air, that's typically one of the ways that you'll find out, but that requires another person to do it. First, let me ask, so if somebody is snoring, how often does that actually mean sleep apnea versus what's the connection?
Sure. So, I mean, I would make clear snoring does not equal sleep apnea. So you can have primary snoring where there's no underlying medical condition. It's just a matter of airflow, maybe from excess tissue, deviated septum, things like that. We ask for other symptoms. And we try and do an evaluation to see what patients have. So snoring is a red flag because it implies that there is some disturbance in airflow, right? Airflow is not smooth. There's some reverberation of air and sound as the patient's breathing in and out that causes the snoring. So that makes things a little bit more helpful, but you don't have to have that. And again, not everyone that snores will have sleep apnea. Now, that being said, in a sleep clinic, which I run, you know, people are coming in because they've got other concerns, or maybe they just come in because they are snoring a lot and they don't really have other concerns. But then when we talk about things, you know, we find out that maybe they're a little more tired than they let on, or, you know, maybe there's some other things that, again, they've been not linking to the snoring.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody is sleeping by themselves, so they don't have a bed partner, most of the time I would assume they're not going to be aware that they're snoring or gasping for air, although sometimes they could. But what things can a person like that sort of pay attention to? What might be signs to them that there's something that should be checked?
Yeah, so waking up at night for no reason, or even waking up at night frequently to go to the bathroom. I would say once or twice to go to the bathroom is, you know, probably common, and maybe even a little bit more in men, you know, older men who might have enlarged prostates. But you could still wake up a lot, and you know, having a sleep apnea evaluation would probably be part of that. If you're waking up four or five times a night, you know, to go to the bathroom, you probably want to make sure there's not something else that is contributing to that. You know, again, some patients, I wouldn't say maybe every patient, but some patients will wake up kind of gasping. Some patients just wake up kind of startled, really. They don't know what happened. They're not sure why they woke up, but it was like some sort of abrupt thing that kind of brought them out of sleep. That could be a red flag. And then, really, you know, if they're tired, how do they feel in the morning? I mean, did they get 6 or 7? I mean, they get 7 or 8 hours of sleep, and they're not really feeling rested, right? Like they feel like they got enough sleep, but they don't feel like they actually got enough sleep. So, are they tired during the day? Those would be things that patients might might identify.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Yeah, and that leads to a question that I want to get to in a minute about people that are tired during the day for other reasons. But before we get to that, I want to ask, and I know there's a lot of listeners of the show who know a lot about sleep already, so this question may sound silly to them, but I think it's a legitimate question that some other people may have that don't know about sleep. And the question is, if you are sleeping with someone who has sleep apnea, is there any concern for you? Can you catch sleep apnea? Can it be transferred over to you?
Yeah, absolutely not. It's not something that that is contagious or that you would pick up. You know, it again has to do more with anatomical characteristics, and those things are just not transmitted from person to person.
Great. Thank you. So, all right, the next question then about this is, we've talked about that there's, you know, excess weight could be one of the factors that could lead to obstructive sleep apnea. Are there any other things, whether we're talking about obstructive or central sleep apnea, are there things that people can do that create sleep apnea for themselves, or really they have no control when we're?
Yeah, I would say in general, it's not something that someone would do something and cause themselves to have sleep apnea. The one possibly exception, although I'm not sure it would cause someone who does not have sleep apnea to develop it, but alcohol can certainly worsen sleep apnea. So someone might have, you know, very mild case, maybe even less than sleep apnea, something we might call upper airway resistance syndrome, where there's some disturbance in airflow, but it's not really meeting the threshold of calling it sleep apnea. And then you throw a couple of drinks on that in the evening. And again, alcohol is a very sedating, relaxing substance. And so that can worsen sleep apnea, sleep disturbed breathing. Central apnea, would really just be people who have, and for the most part, people who have heart failure, who have had strokes. But again, if someone is on narcotic medication, likely even for legitimate reasons, they have a chronic pain syndrome or something, they should know that can be a risk for central apnea. Anyone who's on chronic narcotics could develop central apnea, but other than a specific situation like that, it's not something that someone would just be able to make themselves have that.
Great. Thank you. I'm sure this information is comforting for some people who don't know a lot about sleep apnea. So we're going to talk about sleep apnea treatments in a minute, but before we do that, we've got to take a commercial break here. So I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. You're listening to Sleep Science Today with Dr. Eric Sklar. We will be right back after the break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We were just about to start talking about treatments for the different types of sleep apnea. I know there's a lot of different things out there on the market. So, Dr. Sklar, can you tell us what are the treatments that are available?
Sure. First of all, again, especially in mild cases, weight loss is always a good treatment. So if that's a big factor in the sleep apnea, then we encourage patients to work on weight loss. And in fact, last year, there was a medication approved for treatment of sleep apnea, one of the GLP-1 medications, Zepbound, that has an indication for obstructive sleep apnea, though that does not mean that insurance will automatically cover it, because those medications maybe have some logistical issues with insurance. But that certainly weight loss, aggressive weight loss when appropriate, we always encourage. Some other kind of conservative things that can help would be positional therapy. So typically, sleep apnea would be worse when someone's on their back. That's not all the time, but if someone's a back sleeper, there's a higher likelihood that the tongue might slide back, obstruct the airway. So sleeping on the side would be generally recommended. Again, that's not 100% of the time. Sometimes on a sleep study, we'll see that it's actually a different position that is worse. But generally speaking, the back would be probably the least favorable position for that. And then also elevating the head of the bed or using a wedge so that the head and upper body are somewhat elevated, maybe 15, 20, 25 degrees. That can help as well. Although, of course, the higher you get, the more uncomfortable it can be. So there's kind of a balance in there.
Mm-hmm.
After those basic kind of recommendations, the mainstay of therapy is CPAP, which stands for continuous positive airway pressure.
Can I stop you for a second?
Yeah, sure.
So before we get into CPAP and before we leave, you were talking about the bed and the position and things. I would love to get some information on one other thing, which is I often get questions from patients about what type of mattress should I get? Or is there a type of pillow that's better for my situation if I have sleep apnea? So I'd love to cover that before we get into the CPAPs.
Yeah, sure, sure. So, I mean, I don't think there's, a wedge pillow, which I had mentioned, is probably the most helpful for what we're talking about. Although that's not, you know, for those familiar with a wedge pillow, that's not really like a pillow that you kind of like lie down on. But there's not, you can get these orthotic pillows and memory foam pillows. I would say to use what's comfortable. I don't think that there's one of those that is like more beneficial for sleep apnea. And actually, when I say elevate the head of the bed, I'm not talking about just the head. You know, some patients will try to use like two or three pillows. And so their head is kind of elevated, but their neck is kinked. And, you know, and then by the time the morning comes, they're not on three pillows. Those three pillows are like kind of scattered on the bed. So there's not, I don't think there's a specific type of pillow like that. But as far as beds go, again, nothing specific, although, you know, I can see a benefit to the adjustable bed where you can, instead of using a wedge pillow, you can hit your remote control and kind of, you know, have the head of the bed kind of tilt upward. And that might be a little bit more comfortable than using a wedge or different types of positional things. So, I wouldn't necessarily say anyone has to get an adjustable bed, but if you have sleep apnea and you wanted to incorporate that in your kind of overall treatment plan, if you're in the market for a new mattress, an adjustable bed may be worth thinking about.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you said the adjustable bed to bring up that issue, because I'm finding that those are becoming more and more common and more accessible. And truth be told, I purchased an adjustable bed for myself a few months ago, and I never had one. And what a difference. You're talking about using a wedge pillow versus an adjustable bed. Well, an adjustable bed, because that whole top third kind of lifts itself, it's much more sort of natural to lay on than a wedge. And I find it to be really comfortable because you can go, you know, 5 degrees, 10 degrees, 20 degrees, whatever you want to do. So if you're sitting up in bed reading before you go to bed, you know, you can prop it up almost like a chair if you want. But if you, you know, want to sleep and have your head elevated. So, you know, that's just something that I personally have experienced and found to be really, really helpful.
Yeah, well, that's great. Yeah. Those are the benefits.
Yeah. So, okay. So I cut you off before about CPAPs. Let's talk CPAP.
Yeah, sure. So CPAP, again, continuous positive airway pressure. Basically the way it works, and I'll get into some of the other kind of pros and cons of it, but you wear a mask at night. I know some people don't like that idea, but it basically uses air pressure to splint your airway open. So, you know, if you think about air pressure in a tire, right, the air pressure keeps the tire nice and kind of plump so that it doesn't flatten. And The air pressure that you get through a CPAP mask keeps your airway open and nice and patent so that you can get good, you know, smooth airflow. And then when that happens, you're able to, you know, get into a deeper sleep because you're not having sleep apnea disrupt your sleep. And so CPAP is the gold standard of treatment. It does involve a mask, connected by a tube to a unit that goes on the night table. As we kind of talked about earlier, that there are people who are very skeptical of CPAPs, and I've seen people that have put off evaluation for years and years just because they didn't like the idea of maybe using a CPAP. Although I would always encourage people to get evaluated, see what you have, and then make an informed decision. CPAP is pretty effective. There can be some toleration issues. You know, sometimes there is an adjustment period. So it's just like any other, you know, medication that someone has to get used to, or any other therapy, there's an adjustment period. But when it works, it works really well. Mm-hmm. And there are different types of masks. So, you know, there are what we call a full face mask. That I think is what people are most like scared of, kind of a big like Darth Vader kind of mask over their face. It's not quite over the whole face. It would be over the nose and the mouth. And there are specific reasons to use that kind of mask. If someone's a mouth breather, you want to kind of close the system. And so if air is going to come out through their mouth, you want to have that all in the same kind of closed space. But full face mask is a type of mask. They make a type of mask called a nasal mask, which really goes like around the nose and not over the mouth. These days they make what we call an under the nose full face mask, where instead of going over your nose and mouth, goes over your mouth and then kind of comes up to your nose. And then they also have what's called a nasal pillow mask, where it just goes under your nose and maybe sits in the nostrils a bit. And those are the smallest type masks. So right. There are different masks for different reasons, different things that we try to troubleshoot with. We'll use a different mask here and there. But the masks are usually made of like a soft silicone, and you wash them every night, and then after a few months you have to replace it. They lose some integrity. It's connected to a unit, and we will generally set a pressure. So depending on how extensive the workup was, we'll either have patients at a set pressure of, let's just say, for example, 12 centimeters of water, or in many cases, we'll do what's called an auto CPAP, where we will preset a range of pressures. And the machines these days can kind of sense what kind of pressure is needed at a given time on a given breath, and makes adjustments in the pressure, and so it kind of responds to what's going on there. So CPAP is, again, the main thing. That's the main treatment for obstructive apnea. It's really one of the only treatments for central sleep apnea. There are other types of PAP, positive airway pressure. So as I mentioned, the C stands for continuous. There's right. also BiPAP, which stands for bi-level positive airway pressure. And what that means is that instead of one continuous pressure, there are two pressures. There's one pressure when you breathe in, and then there is another pressure when you breathe out. And so there are certain situations where if someone can't tolerate CPAP, maybe they do better on a BiPAP, because it has a little bit lower pressure for exhaling. As we get a little further into that, there's some other types of PAP things that are used more for people who have central apnea or what we would call complex sleep apnea or treatment emergent sleep apnea. We have some other versions of that, which is BiPAP with a backup rate, or adaptive seroventilation, which involve other algorithms on how the machine works. So again, CPAP is kind of like the first choice for any sleep apnea. Right. And I tell patients that if you have sleep apnea, that is what insurance will cover. I mean, we can pretty much be assured that if someone has sleep apnea, that their insurance would cover CPAP. So what happens if they don't like CPAP or they can't use CPAP? The next thing in line would be what we call an oral appliance or a mandibular repositioning device. This is something I would recommend seeing like an experienced dentist for. But it's an oral mouthpiece that you wear at night, and basically creates kind of an underbite. So it very subtly will shift the bottom jaw forward, and by doing that, the tongue comes forward, and that opens up the airway. And so it's usually fabricated by a dentist, and then they make adjustments in the degree of advancement. And then typically we'll check a follow-up sleep study after it's been adjusted to make sure that it's actually working. And usually if patients are responding to it, they'll feel better and they'll know. But we usually like to check another study just to make sure it's working. And, that has its pros and cons as well. It's very portable. You know, you don't have to worry about taking a little machine and unit with you wherever you go. So it's very portable. It's small, but it can cause, issues with TMJ and jaw misalignment, and the dentists, do things to try and limit that. But that can be, that can be an issue with those. And so insurance will sometimes cover that. And it depends on the plan and whether the patient's tried CPAP or, can tolerate it. So that's something that would be a reasonable option as well. And I find that to be more helpful in like more mild to moderate cases. It probably wouldn't be my first choice in a more severe case. I think those patients are going to do better with CPAP.
Right.
And then they make other things after that generally are not covered by insurance. Bucket of those things is called EPAP, or expiratory positive airway pressure, where you have these devices that you kind of plug into the nose, and when you breathe out, it traps a little bit of your own air. And it uses that air to splint your airway. So you exhale or expire, it will trap some air in there to kind of prevent your airway from closing up. That's another option. But again, it's an out of pocket cost for patients.
Right.
There are some other things. Oh, go ahead.
Let me cut in and stop us for a break here. And then we can continue on with the additional treatments. And I know eventually you're going to get to the implants as well. So we're going to take a break on Sleep Science Today. We'll be back with Dr. Eric Sklar right after the break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
Okay, we're back on Sleep Science Today. We're talking about treatments for sleep apnea, and I interrupted you just before the break, so please continue.
Right. So so I was getting to some other things that would basically be an out of pocket cost for treatment, but are reasonable, legitimate treatments. So they do make a device that basically is a little negative air pressure suction that you put in your mouth, and it is connected by a tube to a little unit, a very small unit that creates a negative suction. And that can pull the tongue forward a bit, and that opens up the airway. Again, insurance doesn't really cover that. There's also, for more mild sleep apnea or even snoring, a device called Excite-OSA, which is a tongue stimulator. So it's not worn at night, but you do a treatment regimen over several weeks where you wear it during the day for a period of time, and it will tone up your tongue. The tongue, again, I mentioned a couple times, is very involved in the collapse of the upper airway. And so if your tongue is more toned, your tongue is a muscle, if it's more toned, it's less likely to slide back. And And so those are a couple of other things that can be used for sleep apnea treatment. Again, probably work better in more mild cases, but treatments nonetheless. As you mentioned, the implant, so to speak, there is a therapy out there that's been around for several years now called Inspire. And that has some specific criteria. That's certainly not a first or even second line therapy, but for patients who have moderate to severe sleep apnea or worse, for patients who generally are not morbidly obese, different insurers have different BMI or body mass index cutoffs to be eligible. And for patients who have tried and failed CPAP, so you can't jump right to Inspire. You have to have tried CPAP, given it a good try, and been shown not to be able to use it. Those patients could be a candidate for Inspire, which is basically a hypoglossal nerve stimulator. So you have a little battery pack kind of implanted in the skin implanted in the chest under the skin. And there is a electrode that sends a signal up to the tongue muscle. Again, we're talking about the tongue. And so we will program that device with a little remote control to turn on at night and stimulate the tongue to contract. And again, when the tongue contracts, that opens up space in the airway and lessens the sleep apnea. So some patients do really well with that. Some patients that we have to tweak it a little bit more. But that is something that is obviously a little bit more permanent. And there are certain criteria for that. So usually it's implanted by an ENT surgeon. And so there are additional tests that they have to do once they've met our criteria. The ENT has to do some other tests to make sure their anatomy would be compatible with the device. So.
Is that done in office or in the hospital? Where do they get it implanted?
Yeah, I mean, it would be in the hospital, or I guess potentially it could happen in a surgical center. Not in the office per se, but it's not, you don't have to stay in the hospital for sufficient time.
Okay. So one thing I also want to get some clarification on is, so we've talked about a lot of different types of treatments for sleep apnea. Are some of those treatments only for obstructive sleep apnea versus central sleep apnea? You know, what applies to what?
Yeah. So I would say everything I've spoken about is for obstructive sleep apnea. Central sleep apnea, like I said, is a little bit different and does not have nearly as many treatments. CPAP would be the treatment of choice. And if patients cannot tolerate that or don't do well on that, then we go to kind of higher level PAP therapy, which would be BiPAP with a backup rate or adaptive seroventilation, which is called ASV. Those are types of PAPs. It's a different algorithm that the machine uses, but it's the same idea, a mask connected by a tube to a machine on the night table. So those, a much more limited amount of therapies for central apnea. There is a device, an implant for central apnea, which is kind of a diaphragm stimulator, which I don't have a lot of experience with. It's a pretty small group of patients that I think are eligible for that. And so I have not had any patients get that, but there is that kind of thing out there. But all the other things I'm talking about that splint the airway open would be for obstructive apnea, because that's where the airway collapses. In central apnea, the airway has not collapsed. The patient's just not taking a breath.
Got it. Thank you. Okay. I want to shift now to a different question. We've got about 5 minutes left in the show, and I want to get to a question that I hear quite often from people. And that question is, why do I always wake up about 3 a.m.? Is there anything to that? Is that an internet myth? Is there a scientific reason? What is your take on it?
Right, right. So, I mean, it's not a myth. I hear that all the time as well. You know, it could be for any number of reasons. But why someone would wake up at like maybe a specific time, I think that probably has more to do with like sleep architecture. So typically when you enter sleep, you know, there are several stages, stage N1 and 2 and 3, stage REM sleep. And basically throughout the night, you cycle through those in kind of 90-minute cycles. So when you are in between cycles or kind of like transitioning to a new cycle, that might be a time where you're more prone to wake up. So that could probably account for kind of like the same time every night. But again, you know, when someone has that kind of complaint, we want to make sure, well, okay, what might be waking them up? You know, is it some subtle sleep apnea? Is it something else? There are a few other things we look at in sleep studies, like periodic limb movements or maybe something in the environment that might wake them up or make them more prone to waking up. So that's part of the evaluation. But as far as like why it might happen at a specific time, that probably has to do with like the sleep architecture and sleep cycles.
Okay. So another common question that I get a lot, this deals with women and hot flashes. They, you know, realistically, understandably complain that they wake up with hot flashes and they can't get back to bed. What should they do? What's the best advice that a sleep doctor has for someone in that situation?
Right. So it's kind of like other situations as well, where there's something else disrupting their sleep, right? Hot flashes themselves are not a sleep disorder. They can certainly disrupt sleep. I hate for this to be a cop-out, but I would usually say that they should talk to their gynecologist or an endocrinologist about how to best treat the hot flashes, because if they don't have the hot flashes or they lessen them, whether it's with medication, I'm certainly not an expert in that field, they're less likely to have them at night as well. I think the question that comes up from a sleep specialist standpoint would be, if they can't get back to sleep, you know, what's going on then? That would create, that would kind of lead into a whole nother line of questioning, you know, in terms of, you know, whether their mind starts to race, whether they've got something else going on or things like that. So that could lead into a whole other question. But no, the hot flashes are definitely a real thing. But just like any other non-sleep disorder thing, we would say, you know, treat the problem, treat the issue that's causing it. And if it's been disrupting sleep, then treating that problem should hopefully lessen sleep disruption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, the point that you make about the fact that every patient basically is unique, because everybody's situation is different. And when you start digging into some of these questions, you might find out, well, you know, yeah, I wake up at a certain time every night. It just happens to be that I also have a young child who tends to get up at that time and come in my room and, you know, jump on the bed. Or I have a pet, a dog, who needs to go out at, you know, 5 a.m. or whatever it may be. So as you start digging into it, you start to find, you know, things that are relevant. Not to say that there's plenty of people who don't have any particular thing that they can think of. And then it takes a little bit of questioning and investigation to get a better sense of what might be going on. For me, oftentimes I find, you know, anxiety is a big factor, because mm-hmm. they're so worried about some issue that's coming up at work or,
right.
you know, finances or whatever.
Yeah, definitely.
So, well, I do have to, you know, end us here, because we have reached the end of our time. There's so many more questions that I would have liked to have asked, but maybe we'll have you back at another time to talk about sleep medications, which I know is a show in and of itself.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us. For those of you listening, you can always go to sleepsciencetoday.com to get access to our podcasts and the YouTube stream for this, as well as other helpful information. So this has been Sleep Science Today with Dr. Eric Sklar. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and we will see you on the next episode.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.